Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven, saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear, Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you'd best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is January the 3rd, Sunday, 2010. Bill Fink is joining us for Bolshevism in Russia, Part 2. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello. Praise Yahweh.
Absolutely. Praise Yahweh. So last week, we got into Bolshevism in Russia. We read some of the first pages. We covered the report from the minister, ambassador from the Netherlands, who was assigned as the representative to the foreign ministry at Petrograd, and he explicitly said that the Bolshevik movement was a movement worked by Jews who have no nationality and whose one object is to destroy for their own ends the existing order of things. And he said that the danger posed by the Bolshevik Revolution was even greater than that posed by the war against Germany and Austria-Hungary that was still going on, and that if not stopped immediately, Bolshevism would spread over the entire world.
And that was pretty prophetic of him, wasn't it?
Since here we are today.
And today we're a socialist nation. We're far down that path, and we're on our way to becoming a Bolshevik nation. There's no doubt.
Absolutely.
That there's no doubt, and I don't know who's going to stand up and stop it, except Jesus Christ himself. That's who we need to stop this. It's a poison, and most of our own people are already poisoned with it.
And we never had a Hitler, so we never had any mortal in this country try and stand up and say no more.
No, and I think that, we gave into the Cultural Revolution. And that's why we never had a war. We haven't been invaded because we succumbed to the Jewish Cultural Revolution, and we were invaded by a minority, but we lost the cultural battle. Well, we've succumbed totally to the Jews in the cultural battle. When you see fags marching down Fifth Avenue celebrating their perversity, well then we've lost the battle. There's no doubt. And most people are totally apathetic.
And had we not capitulated, we probably would have had a war with the Soviet Union sometime in the 60s, 70s, or maybe the 80s at the latest.
Well, I absolutely believe so. If we'd have stopped the Cultural Revolution and if we'd have drawn the line, that then I'm sure that the world banking powers would have brought us into an overt war.
And they probably would have... They wouldn't have hesitated to start a nuclear war because it would have just meant the death of tens of millions of white Russians and probably 100 plus million white Americans.
Right, they wouldn't care about that.
Or they would just bring in the Chinese. China has more men than... Oh, sorry, go on.
It's part of their population reduction program in the first place. I mean, that's part of their game.
China probably has more men than America has rifles.
Now they do, yes. And they've gotten that way because we've, through our Jewish capitalism, we've gifted them with all of our technology and our industry.
Shall we begin with number 7?
Yes, this is the reports of the arrest of the Russian family, and it's a good insight to see how they operate.
All right. Number 7, Mr. Alston to Mr. Balfour, received September 18, telegraphic, Vladivostok, September 16, 1918. His Majesty's Counsel at Ekaterinburg, Mr. Preston, who left that place on the 1st September, has just arrived here and has given following information as to fate of Russian imperial family. Ex-Emperor of Russia and Grand Duchess Tatiana were brought from Tobolsk to Ekaterinburg by Bolsheviks on the 1st May, 1918. Emperor was given suitable quarters near British consulate. Rest of imperial family, including ex-empress, other three daughters, and Tsarevich, arrived a few days later. Members of suite, including Prince Dolgorukiy, as well as British and French tutors who came with imperial family from Tobolsk, were not allowed to remain with Emperor at Ekaterinburg and were returned to Tobolsk. Prince Dolgorukai was kept in prison, where he either eventually died or was killed. Prince Dolgorukai, I really can't pronounce these names, frequently asked me as doyen of consular corps at least to try and obtain better conditions of living for imperial family. It was impossible for me, however, to do anything, and when I interceded for the princess, whom I said I was protecting as a Serbian ally, I was threatened with arrest. When the Czech advance on Chelyabinsk commenced, the Ekaterinburg Bolshevik government, who already had considerable friction with central Bolshevik government on money matters, began to use threats against the imperial family as a means of extorting funds from central government. When Bolsheviks knew they would have to evacuate Ekaterinburg owing to the approach of the Czechs, they asked the people's commissars at Moscow what they should do with the emperor. The reply they received was, quote, do whatever you think fit, end quote.
Now, why would they have no interest in the emperor? That's pretty amazing to me that would be the reply.
At a meeting of the Ural Soldiers and Workmen's Delegates held on 16 July, a decision was come to that the emperor should be shot, and this decision was communicated to him and sentence carried out by Lettish soldiers same night. However,
now,
no
Lettish
trace...
soldiers are Lithuanian soldiers,
yes.
And they're generally a pretty noble race, and I think they're hardly candidates for perpetrating the unjust murder of the Emperor of Russia.
I would assume Lithuanian Jews, wouldn't you?
Well, you know, Lettish soldiers, these are people that are already so it's hard to for me to see exactly what's going on here, but I would think maybe not. I don't know. It's hard to tell, but I would think maybe not. I would think these were regular army Lithuanians.
The Bolsheviks did encourage a lot of ethnic rivalry between the Russians and the various other constituent peoples of the Russian Empire, didn't they?
Well, yes, they did. And I'm not sure to the extent that that Lithuania was infiltrated by Jews at this time.
All right. However, no trace has ever been found of the body. The rest of members of imperial family were taken away to an unknown destination immediately after this. It is said that they were burnt alive, as various articles of jewelry have been identified as belonging to them by their old servants, and their charred remains are said to have been found in a house burnt to the ground. It is still thought possible that the Bolsheviks took them north when they retreated to Verkhotorye. The following Grand Dukes were in captivity near Ekaterinburg at Opalvsk. Besides the ex-emperor, George Konstantinovich, Ivan Konstantinovich, and Sergei Mikhailovich, Princess Helena of Serbia, the wife of the Grand Duke Ivan Konstantinovich, was frequently at the British consulate where everything possible was done for her. But in spite of my energetic protests, the Bolsheviks took the princess with them when they evacuated the town. Of course they were. They probably weren't done with her yet, were they?
Well, right, I'm sure. But we're going to see that these, a lot of the Grand Dukes and the Duchesses, their bodies were found, and they were killed. But the royal family, their bodies were never found. And when you see the subsequent reports, there's a lot of doubt over whether or not they were really killed.
Mm. With the help of local white guards, the three above-mentioned Grand Dukes managed to escape from their captivity, but it is not known where they are at present. End of number 7.
Right, that report's up in the air. That report, you know, he's saying it is, you know, he's not saying that the bodies were actually burned, but that it's believed that they are. And there's a lot of doubt in the reports that are coming up.
Would you like to start number 8?
Yes, this is from a Mr. C. Elliott. Well, from a Sir C. Elliott to Mr. Balfour, January 2nd, 1919. Sir, I have from Ekaterinburg. Sir, I have the honor to submit the following report of what is known respecting the fate of the Russian imperial family, as well as a short narrative written at my request by Mr. Sidney Gibbs, formerly tutor to His Imperial Highness the Tsarevich. So evidently the Tsar's children had British tutors. Mr. Gibbs accompanied the imperial children from Tobolsk to Ekaterinburg on May 23rd, but was not allowed to live in a house where they were confined with their parents in the later town. The Bolsheviks of Ekaterinburg stated in speeches and proclamations that the Tsar was shot on a night of July 16th, but many of the best-informed Russians believe that he is still alive and in German custody. They never produced the body. I dare not, however, indulge the hope that this is true unless some more adequate explanation than those current can be given of the supposed action of the Bolsheviks. The official in charge of the inquiry at the time of my visit showed me over the house where the imperial family resided. He dismissed as pure inventions the stories commonly believed in Siberia, such as that the corpse had been discovered, or that a member of the firing party had made a confession. On the other hand, he said that all the narratives of the persons who thought they had seen the emperor after July 16th had proven to be entirely without foundation. Now this could just be official propaganda that he's being given, and it seems to be that. In his own opinion, the chances were 4-3 that the murder had been perpetrated. The house stands on the side of a hill, and the entrance leads into the first floor where the imperial family lived, the ground floor in which the guard was quartered, consisting of offices and kitchens. The latter, however, were not used for cooking, the only food allowed being military rations brought in from outside and some special dishes for the Tsarevich, which were supplied by the nuns of a neighboring convent. A high wooden palisade hid the windows of the upper story, which were also whitewashed inside and kept closed even in the heat of summer. The imperial family had to endure considerable hardships and insolence while they lived in this house. They were allowed only one walk of 15 minutes in the garden every day, but the Tsar found distraction in doing carpentering work in an open shed. At meals, the soldiers sometimes came in and took part of the meal off the table, part of the meat off the table, saying that there was too much and the imperial family were not allowed decent privacy. The rooms, when I saw them, presented a melancholy and dirty appearance because the Bolsheviks had burnt a great quantity of objects in the stoves, and the ashes were subsequently taken out by the police and spread on the tables and floor with the object of discovering if they contained anything interesting. And we're going to see some interesting things here, because there are apps that they even talk about that the murders being perpetrated in this house and a police investigation. I don't know. I don't understand why, if the Bolsheviks wanted them dead, there would be a police investigation. I can't figure that part out.
Yes.
I'll read on. There appears to be no evidence whatever to corroborate the popular story that on the night of July 16th, the Tsar was taken out of the house and shot by a firing party in the manner usual at Bolshevik executions. But there is some evidence that sounds of uproar and shooting were heard in the house that night, and that no traffic was allowed in the streets near it. The murder is believed to have taken place in a room on the ground floor, which was sealed up but kindly opened for my inspection. It was quite empty. The floor was of plain wood, and the walls coated with plaster. Doggerel verses and indecent figures were scrawled on them. There was graffiti on the walls and lewd pictures. That's typical Jewish graffiti. Mm-hmm. On the wall opposite the door and on the floor were the marks of 17 bullets, or to be more accurate, and it's not really bullets as we see, marks showing where pieces of the wall and floor had been cut out in order to remove the bullet holes. The officials charged with the investigation having thought fit to take them away for examination elsewhere. And that's what sounds strange to me. If they decided to kill this man, the Bolsheviks, and why would they be cutting away pieces of the floor and the wall for investigations?
Absolutely. You'd think that there wouldn't be an investigation.
Yeah, they would know what happened and they wouldn't care. And that's, this whole thing doesn't add up. They stated that Browning revolver bullets were found in all the holes and that some of them were stained with blood. Otherwise, no traces of blood were visible, but there were some signs that the wall had been scraped and washed. The position of the bullets indicated that the victims had been shot when kneeling. Well, he said he didn't see the bullets, and that other shots had been fired into them when they had fallen on the floor. Mr. Gibbs thought that for religious reasons, the Tsar and Dr. Botkin would be sure to kneel when facing death. There is no real evidence as to who or how many victims there were, but as to who or how many the victims were, but it is supposed that there were five, namely the Tsar, Dr. Bokhin, the Empress's maid, and two lackeys. No corpses were discovered, nor any trace of their having been disposed of by burning or otherwise. But it was stated that a finger bearing a ring believed to have been Dr. Bokhin was found in a well. Well, that whole account sounds like a lie and a cover-up for something. On the 17th of July, a train with the blinds down left Ekaterinburg for an unknown destination, and it is believed that the surviving members of the imperial family were in it. It will be seen from the above account that the statement of the Bolsheviks is the only evidence for the death of the Tsar, and it is an easy task for ingenuous and sanguine minds to invent narratives giving a plausible account of His Imperial Majesty's escape. It must indeed be admitted that since the Empress and her children, who are believed to be still alive, have totally disappeared, there is nothing unreasonable in supposing the Tsar to be in the same case. The marks in the room at Ekaterinburg prove at most that some persons unknown were shot there and might even be explained as the result of a drunken brawl. But I fear that another train of thought is nearer to the truth. It seems to me eminently probable that the Bolsheviks of Moscow, or a section of them, wished to hand over the Tsar to the Germans. With this object, a commissioner went to Tobolsk and removed their imperial majesties in a summary but not unkindly manner, probably intending to take them to Moscow. This is all conjecture on his part. He evidently knew that the temper of the Siberian Bolsheviks was doubtful, for he stopped the train outside Omsk, and finding that the local authorities intended to arrest the Tsar, he ordered the train to leave for Ekaterinburg, that is, to take the only other route to Moscow. But when the train reached Ekaterinburg, it was stopped by the local authorities and all the occupants removed. Subsequently, the imperial children were brought to Ekaterinburg from Tobolsk and placed in custody with their parents. The treatment of the imperial family at Ekaterinburg shows an animus which was entirely wanting at Tobolsk, and the Bolsheviks became more hostile and suspicious as they felt their own reign was coming to an end and that they must leave the city. There is some evidence that they were much alarmed by an aeroplane flying over the garden of the house, and I fear it is comprehensible that in a fit of rage and panic, they made away with His Imperial Majesty. It is the general opinion in Ekaterinburg that the Empress, her son, and four daughters were not murdered, but were dispatched on the 17th of July to the north or the west. The story that they were burnt in a house seems to be an exaggeration of the fact that in a wood outside the town, there was found a heap of ashes, apparently the result of burning a considerable quantity of clothing. At the bottom of the ashes was a diamond, and as one of the Grand Duchesses is said to have sewn a diamond into the lining of her cloak, it is supposed that the clothes of the imperial family were burnt here. Also, hair, identified as belonging to one of the Grand Duchesses, was found in the house. It is, therefore seems probable that the imperial family were disguised before the removal. At Ekaterinburg, I did not even hear a rumor as to their fate, but subsequent stories about the murder of various Grand Dukes and Grand Duchesses cannot but inspire apprehension. Now, one thing we see Well, the first thing is that it's really unsure at this point of the fate of the royal family. And another thing we see is that the Bolsheviks, even at this point, were that they felt that their own control of the country was shaky. That they could still, that their revolution still may fail.
So they knew that their hold was precarious.
Yes, and they still believe so. And this is, well, the events are July of, supposedly, of 1918. This is received by Mr. Balfour in January of 1919. It was filed in October of 1918.
I was going to say, at this point, had the Western nations heeded the call put out by the Dutch minister, they could have basically snuffed out Bolshevism in the cradle. And that would have been the end of it.
Well, absolutely, but well, it didn't happen, but it was that there were still further attempts at this point. The Czechs are still evidently trying to make their way to Moscow, as he mentions. And we'll see that mentioned later also. There were still attempts to stop this revolution from outside. They just failed.
You have anything from the Third Rome that you'd like to tie into any of this at the present time, or shall we go on to number?
No,
the enclosure?
Just go on. I tried to look in the Third Rome to see what the state of the Russian peasantry was as far as firearms was concerned, but I couldn't find anything, which was
right.
Sort of disappointing. That the Russians they had to be armed at some point. The Russian people. Well, we'll get into that a little later.
Shall we continue with the enclosure of number 8, or shall we go right on to number 9 and skip over the enclosure about specific conditions?
Well, the enclosure in number 8, it has some details of the last days of the royal family in Tobolsk, and it talks about the emperor's health actually improving while he's exiled in Tobolsk. But it also believes that many members of the imperial family appeared killed at Alpovsk, a small town near Ekaterinburg, and report number 9 will basically verify that, I believe. So number 8 in itself isn't important. It's only going to – it's a report by a Mr. Sidney Gibbs, who was a tutor of the Tsar's son, the Tsarevich, and it basically only reinforces the things that we just discussed.
All right, so let's just jump right ahead to number 9 then. Mr. Alston to Mr. Balfour, received November 5. Telegraphic, Vladivostok, November 4, 1918. Following from Consulatic Rottenburg, 28th October. Regret to report I am informed by Russian staff that when Apovelisk was taken by Russian troops on 29 September, corpses sufficiently preserved to be recognized as Grand Duchess Elizabeth Fedorovna and of 3 royal princes, John Constantine, Igor Konstantinovich, and also that of Grand Duke Sergei Mikhailovich, and lady-in-waiting, name yet unknown, were found in mine pit in which they had been thrown, presumably alive, bombs being thrown on them which did not effectively explode. All were buried with ceremonial large crowds attending. Princess Helene of Serbia, believed to be at Perm, where she was taken by Bolsheviks with Serbian mission when Bolsheviks evacuated at Grotenburg, making thorough investigation. And this sounds like one of the later claims that they would bring against the Germans, that Germans buried them alive, threw them in the pits, and did all these horrible things to them. Yet here we are, we're seeing that they've done it to people 20, 30 years before.
Well, they did it throughout the 30 years before, not just 30 years before. I mean, they did it throughout the whole reign of terror in the Soviet Union. And the Jews consistently take their own crimes and transfer them to others. Throughout history, there's no doubt. A lot of the things that they did to Germans during the Second World War as partisans, they accused the Germans of doing. A lot of things that the Soviet Jews did to Poles, they accused the Germans of doing. There's no doubt they consistently blame others. It boils down to the fact that the Pharisees always judged hypocritically, that they condemned others for doing the things that they did.
So basically we could say that the difference between a National Socialist and a Jew is that the Jew is actually guilty of the crimes he's been accused of.
Absolutely. There's no doubt. Report number 10. A Mr. Lockhart to Sir G. Clerk. Who is evidently, I guess he works with Mr. Balfour. I don't know why he's writing him and not Balfour suddenly. Dear Sir George, the following points may interest Mr. Balfour. The Bolsheviks have established a rule of force and oppression unequaled in the history of any autocracy. I don't know why he thought the Bolsheviks wanted to form an autocracy. That themselves, that's the last thing they wanted. Themselves the fiercest upholders of the right of free speech, They have suppressed, since coming into power, every newspaper which does not approve their policy. Isn't that what they're doing right now here? I mean, it's much more subtle here. But for 50 years, they cried about free speech. And these last couple of administrations, the Jews have really consolidated power over this country. And it's culminating in this Obama administration. And they want to suppress free speech all of a sudden. And the ADL is calling the whole right wing, you know, haters and hate speech. And it's really just an attempt to demonize all of their political opposition. And it's the ADL behind all these hate bills, these hate crimes bills and hate speech bills. So
or what they do is
that they're very overt about it in the Soviet, you know, in Russia 100 years ago. They were very open and very rapid about it. But here they've been very gradual and very slow to do the same thing. It's the same goals. They've just done it very gradually here.
Or here they buy up all the opposition using money that they basically get out of the government.
Well, that too, and I'll bring that up later with Herod the Great.
I noticed it's a big scam that the Jews get their people elected to Congress. Congress votes aid money to Israel. They take money from us, send it to Israel. Then the Israelis kick some of it back to their lobby groups here, and they basically buy up our media to keep putting out pro-Israeli stories.
Right. Absolutely. Herod did the same thing in Judea in the first century B.C. He turned against his own countrymen who rebelled from the Romans. He crushed the rebellion. He took all their property, and he bribed the Romans with it to be made king. He did the same thing. It's basically the same, that they destroy a people with their own property, that they look for an opportunity to steal your property and take your wealth and then destroy you with your own wealth. Over and over again, it's the same pattern. Because the Jew by himself produces nothing. Nothing except discord, dissension, agitation. Okay, so we see that as soon as the Bolsheviks, the upholders of the right of free speech, gain power, they want to crush it. In this respect, the socialist press has suffered most of all. Even the papers of the internationalist Mensheviks like Martov have been suppressed and closed down, and the unfortunate editors thrown into prison or forced to flee for their lives. The right of holding public meetings has been abolished. The vote has been taken away from everyone except the workmen in the factories and the poorer servants. And even amongst the workmen, those who dare to vote against the Bolsheviks are marked down by the Bolshevik secret police as counter-revolutionaries, and are fortunate if their worst fate is to be thrown into prison, of which in Russia today, it may truly be said, many go in but few come out. The worst crimes of the Bolsheviks have been against their socialist opponents. Of the countless executions which the Bolsheviks have carried out, a large percentage has fallen on the heads of socialists who had waged a lifelong struggle against the old regime, but who are now denounced as counter-revolutionaries merely because they disapprove of the manner in which the Bolsheviks have discredited socialism. The Bolsheviks have abolished even the most primitive forms of justice. Thousands of men and women have been shot without even the mockery of a trial, and thousands more are left to rot in the prisons under conditions to find a parallel to one to which one must turn to the darkest annals of Indian or Chinese history. The Bolsheviks have restored the barbarous methods of torture. The examination of prisoners frequently takes place with a revolver at the unfortunate prisoner's head. The Bolsheviks have established the odious practice of taking hostages. Still worse, they have struck at their political opponents through their womenfolk. When recently a long list of hostages was published in Petrograd, the Bolsheviks seized the wives of those men whom they could not find and threw them into prison until their husbands should give themselves up. I like to say that the English did the same thing to the Dutch in the Boer Wars, and that's the Jews of England doing that.
I'd like to point out too at this point that most of the officers that were fighting on behalf of Trotsky were former Tsarist officers who were only fighting because their family members had been taken hostage, and they were told that they'll be killed unless you fight for us against the White Army.
Right, and that's evident in later reports that we're coming up to. The Bolsheviks who destroyed the Russian army and who have always been the avowed opponents of militarism have forcibly mobilized officers who do not share their political views, but whose technical knowledge is indispensable, and by the threat of immediate execution have forced them to fight against their fellow countrymen in a civil war of unparalleled horror. So that's what you're doing. That's what you're just talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
The avowed ambition of Lenin is to create civil warfare throughout Europe. Every speech of Lenin's is a denunciation of constitutional methods and a glorification of the doctrine of physical force. With that object in view, he is destroying systematically, both by executions and by deliberate starvation, every form of opposition to Bolshevism. This system of terror is aimed chiefly at the liberals and non-Bolshevik socialists, whom Lenin regards as his most dangerous opponents. In order to maintain their popularity with the working men and with their hired mercenaries, the Bolsheviks are paying their supporters enormous wages by means of an unchecked paper issue. Until today, money in Russia has naturally lost all value. Even according to their own figures, the Bolsheviks' expenditure exceeds the revenue by thousands of millions of rubles per annum. These are facts for which the Bolsheviks may seek to find an excuse, but which they cannot deny. Now this is a page out of the Roman history book, because the later Roman military dictators turned to maintaining power by paying the armies and the soldiers huge sums at the expense of the taxpayers and the people and the treasury. They did it all the time. They would buy the soldiers and buy their power and try to make up for it with increased taxes.
Well, that's what they're doing in Zimbabwe, you know, since the Zimbabwean economy has totally imploded. Mugabe lets his soldiers routinely just go through the business district of Harare, and they can walk into an electronic shop, and if there happens to be a TV in there that they want, they can just walk right out with it.
It's also sort of what they're doing here. I mean, the only people here with jobs that are secure right now are the government workers and the hospital workers and the teachers and the bankers, but and the politicians. But it's the government class that has the most secure position in this economy that we're living through now.
Basically, the people that are voluntarily being whores for the system.
Absolutely. The ever-growing prison system, the ever-growing law enforcement complex in this country, and they perpetuate the government and keep it in power. It's the same pattern. It's just much more subtle. And this is basically the it's basically a disgrace for us to have this information. And the British had this information. And I'm sure that enough intellects here knew it, and there are right-wing intellects somewhere, that we took the side, even knowing Lenin's plan to create, you know, civil unrest and revolution all throughout Europe, civil warfare throughout Europe, as this gentleman puts it. We took Stalin's side against Christian Germany. That's absolutely incredible that we did that.
Well, this country was run by the Jew Rosenfeld at the time.
Well, it definitely proves so. But still, we went along with this, and we are proud of our achievement today. We consider, you know, the American people as a people. Actually, consider today. Our people glorify our achievements, and by our, I mean the entire English-speaking world, in Europe during the Second World War. when all we really did was side with these same Jewish gangsters in the destruction of Central Europe. And at the time, Central Europe was becoming a stronghold of Christendom against the Jews and the communists. And World War II is our greatest shame. And with everybody in identity should understand that. And there's a lot of people in identity that don't. And they follow the Jew propaganda that Hitler was a Nazi and Hitler was evil. And that's all Jewish propaganda.
Well, when have the Jews ever told the truth? The same people that so vigorously deny Jesus, they tell us that Hitler is this demon, Satan in human form. And yet white Christian Americans believe them. Why should we believe anything the Jew says?
Well, right. And identity Christians should certainly know better. Okay, you want to read report number 11?
All right, report number 11. Reports on conditions in Russia. 1. Report on Bolshevik realities by Ms. L., rest of the name blanked out, formerly organizer and controller of a large war hospital in Moscow, who left Russia in October 1918. The
right,
peasants in the land.
This is a good report. This name, if you read the footnote, as some of those who have handed in reports or been interviewed have relatives and property in Russia. Well, she had property in Russia, and she probably had relatives, and contemplate returning there after the Bolshevik regime is at an end. Their names have been suppressed. That's why her name is blanked out. And that's they're thinking that the Bolshevik regime would end soon is evident right there in that footnote, right?
Mm-hmm. But identifying that she works for this large war hospital in Moscow, they'll probably figure out who they're talking about.
Yeah, just
I'm
find
sure
the woman whose name begins with an L that's missing.
And I'm sure the Cheka went to work on that right away. The peasants in the land. Already under the regime of the provisional government, the land had been handed over to the whole body of the peasants in each district. But it must be borne in mind that the Russian peasant has a strongly developed sense of property, and all his hopes were centered on an ultimate dividing of the land, which would make each one an individual proprietor and guarantee him the secure ownership of his holding. The Bolsheviks, however, regarding the land as the property of the nation as a whole, ordered the peasants to cultivate the fields for the benefit of the local commune. The peasants, disappointed in their hopes, soon began to express their disapproval of the new policy. This brought upon them the accusation of disloyalty to the Soviet government, and their antagonism was countered by the appointment in each district of komitere bednotai, committees consisting of the poorest class of peasants, who disposed of the crop, leaving a certain amount in possession of those who had grown it and taking the rest for themselves. This meant that the drones got all they needed without doing any productive work and was equivalent to a premium on idleness. Isn't that what Bolshevism always promotes?
Well, right, and this woman's report really exposes that at a very early time, that they understood that Bolshevist principles destroy the productivity of a nation.
The inevitable result was a steady decline in the crops, which will in the end prove the ruin of agricultural Russia. The factories and the workmen. Under the provisional government, workmen's committee were formed, which dealt with such questions as hiring of labor, deciding the scale of pensions, allowances and bonuses, and the whole administration of the factory. Selling prices were controlled and profits were allocated in the proportion of 95% to the state and 5% to the owner. In practice, this scheme resulted in continual reconstruction of the committees on the ground that the bonuses were too low or pensions unfairly awarded. The committees were never in power long enough to get acquainted with the details of the business. At the beginning of their regime, the Bolsheviks did not alter this system, but gradually changes leading towards nationalization were inaugurated. In March 1918, private trade was put an end to, and a central board for every industry was set up, which collected the produce from various firms. The selling prices were fixed by decree, but payment out of which wages and expenses had to come was made by the central board only after long delay and repeated demand. In July, all factories were nationalized and handed over to the workmen under the direction of the central boards, which functioned in a most despotic manner. All owners and managers were turned out and could not re-enter the works unless elected. At the slightest opposition or protest, the workmen were thrown into prison, field guns brought out, and the threat made to raze the factory to the ground. Wages and food. The minimum wage for a workman was fixed at 500 rubles per month, while superior artisans, a very small percentage of the community, received up to a maximum of 1,000 rubles per month. And generally, wouldn't all the Jews fall under the artisan category?
Well, I'm sure they would make themselves. They would claim to be artisans, if you want to call any of their work art.
This sum was fixed on the assumption that the official rations were inadequate. In actual fact, the scale was ludicrously insufficient to maintain life. Up till September 1916, the bread ration was 1/4 pound to 1/2 pound per day for workmen and 1/6 per pound for others. The bread was of very low standard, was full of refuse of all kinds, and of the consistency of putty. Even this ration was seldom to be had. True, certain things could be obtained by underhand means, as for example black flour at 10 rubles per pound, equivalent to 6 pence today, butter at 39 rubles per pound, sugar at 39 rubles per pound, eggs at 27 rubles per pound. From this, it is quite evident that the wage of 500 rubles was inadequate for the upkeep of a family. As a result, the workpeople tried to bring supplies into the town from districts where the prices were lower. This practice was strongly forbidden by the government because it upset their, quote, rationing organization, and strong measures were taken to repress it. A train returning from one of the food areas would be held up by a body of Red Guards established at some point on the line. These guards would open fire on the train, and almost invariably some of the passengers were shot. All had their provisions confiscated, and the wretched workman returned to his home minus money and flour and having lost 2 or 3 days' work. These food hunting expeditions disorganized the whole of the factories, as a third of the men were always absent. When it is remembered that clothing, rent, and other necessities had also to be provided out of the 500 rubles, it will be understood how deplorable were the conditions of life. Materials and made-up clothing were also rationed, but there was hardly enough to supply the needs of 1/10 of the population. The result of the struggle between the workmen and the government, and the inefficiency of the latter's subordinate officials, is that the Russian factories are rapidly falling into a state of ruin. Output has decreased in some cases 90%, and as there is no available supply of fuel or raw materials, it is only a question of a few months, if the Bolsheviks remain in power, before the factories will be forced to close down. Repression of democracy. After the July Congress and the anti-Bolshevik demonstration of the left social revolutionaries, non-Bolshevik socialists were deprived of all political rights. Hundreds of socialist workmen were thrown into prison and large numbers were shot. In addition, 3,000 workmen were thrown out of employment in the tramway repairing shops in Moscow simply on the ground of their social revolutionary sympathies. The best illustrations of the autocratic rule under which the workmen now exist is the fact that all public expression of opinion has been forbidden. All non-Bolshevik newspapers have been suppressed, including even the Independent Socialist, whose editor, Martov, had a worldwide reputation in socialist circles. All public meetings except those organized by the Bolsheviks are prohibited, and the Bolsheviks call themselves, quote, the peasants and workmen's government, quote. The most serious crime in the eyes of the Bolsheviks is anti-Bolshevism, and the work of discovering and punishing offenders of this kind is in the hands of the Extraordinary Commission, an autocratic body which arrests, examines, imprisons, and executes at will. There is no charge, no public trial, and no appeal. There are English works foremen in prison in Moscow today with nothing against them except the fact that they happen to be in a certain street or square at a time when the Red Guards took it into their heads to make a general arrest. Appeals from the Red Cross and the neutral consuls are unavailing. The commissar in charge of the case is away ill, and nothing can be done till his return. Crimes of street robbery, etc., are punished in a rough and ready way. The offender is shot on the spot, and the body left there till someone thinks good to remove it. To describe the life inside the prisons would require the pen of Charles Reed. Even using the greatest restraint and moderation, any accounts must appear exaggerated and hysterical to English readers. In verminous, ill-ventilated cells, starved and terrorized people are crowded together in one room. Men, women, young girls, the latter held as hostages to force their hiding fathers or brothers to give themselves up. At 6 o'clock in the evening, the doors are locked and no one is allowed out for any reason till morning, except those called out at about 3 a.m. for execution. Healthy and sick, some with cholera, are huddled on the floor, uncertain of their fate, and knowing it is out of the power of anyone to help them. The food consists of 1/4 of a pound of black bread and a bowl of hot water, in which are floating some pieces of cabbage and occasionally a few fish heads. Red Cross officials noticed a rapid change in the appearance of prisoners. They looked each day more haggard, drawn, and hopeless. Would you like to continue?
In less than 14 months from the time of the October Revolution, Bolshevik policies have destroyed the entire economy of Russia. And that, as we saw last week in the Third Rome, was a very vibrant economy. And it grew very, very greatly between 1898 and 1913 alone, where most production had risen from anywhere from 60 to 150%. And where the national debt was amounted to 59 rubles per person. And where the actual taxation burden of each citizen was less than 10 rubles a year. And now with inflation under the Bolsheviks, 1,000 rubles a year, and people can't even get by on that. So that's some pretty incredible that's some pretty incredible inflation. And it's a pretty rapid destruction of the Russian economy. And where it's, you know, they've been at it for 50 or 60 years here, and they've gradually destroyed our economy. In Soviet Russia, they did it in a year and a half, which is just incredible. Now we see that the common people, the common people are suffering. According to this report, the common people are suffering greatly. And when you look at the Reign of Terror in the French Revolution, the common people also suffered greatly. And these revolutions are perpetrated in with the advertising that it's the common man that's going to be stood up for, that it's the working man that's going to be raised up and benefit. But that's never the result, is it?
Absolutely not. They're just using people as useful idiots, and when they're no longer needed, bang, they're shot.
Well, they use the common man to gain power. That they use the masses to gain power, and then they treat them worse than the first king. That seems to be pretty much a pattern over and over again. In the Reign of Terror under Robespierre, among people who were condemned by the revolutionary tribunals, about 18% were aristocrats, 6% clergy, 4% middle class, and 72% were workers or peasants accused of hoarding, evading the draft, desertion, rebellion, and other purported minimal crimes. And here in the Bolshevik Revolution, we see the same pattern. That it's the people that were supposed to be helped that are suffering the most.
How else would they come to power other than exploiting the working class?
Well, right, but they exploit the working class and then they destroy it. And in Russia, it only took a year and a half, which is incredibly quick. All right, the second part of this report is by a Mr. H, Vladimir H, October 14th, 1918. So that's not even a year and a half, that's a year. Our mills continued to work under the most adverse conditions, which grew from bad to worse during the course of the years 1917-1918, owing to labor disorganization, shortage of raw material, money. From a balance of 35 million rubles, we now owe 25 million rubles to the state bank. So this company has been looted of 60 million rubles in a year. And finally, of food for the work people. The large shell manufacturing plant, during the course of the war we had developed, had to be closed down by orders of the Soviet. Famine and cholera finally made their appearance, and the work people and their families, especially children, commenced to die and to grow so weak as to seriously impair their capacity for work. My co-directors and myself were powerless to do anything, to help or to do anything in the matter, as the Soviet had taken over everything connected with the working of the concern, putting in utterly incapable people, such as doorkeepers, watchmen, etc., to supervise work demanding long experience, technical and medical knowledge, even interfering with the hospital administration, where the man cook supervised the work of our doctors. A cook supervised the work of their doctors. As the mill position grew worse and matters became impossible, I was charged with sabotage and working as an agent of England to paralyze industry in our district. All the sales and purchases of materials and goods were made through the agency of the Soviet, who employed dishonest persons, with the result that though our goods were ostensibly sold to various representative bodies, such as other Soviet organizations, in reality they were made the objects of speculation and theft, and sold in some cases to known German agents and sent to Germany. This
doubtlessly
was known,
Jews.
And I'm sure it was probably Jews in Germany, you're right. This was known to the work people, who were greatly excited by the matter. Shortage of food, the supply and disposal of which became a Soviet monopoly, with the usual result of stopping all supplies, forced the work people to travel to the grain districts in the south and east of Russia and obtain supplies there themselves, which we'll see in a minute didn't work too well either. The supplies, in order to preserve the principle of Soviet monopoly, were usually confiscated by the Red Army and requisitioned commandos from the unfortunate people on their return journeys on the railways. So people were dumb enough to go buy food and let the Army steal it from them. These Red Army requisition commandos are charged with the duty of stopping all private trading and so-called speculation, but being in many cases utterly devoid of any idea of honesty or duty, merely took the food and resold the same, in many cases, to the people again. So the whole thing is just organized robbery. It's an organized destruction and looting and pillaging of this entire nation by the Jews.
Isn't that what they're doing in this country? Isn't that what they're doing in this country right now?
Well, yeah, they're doing it in this country now, but the sad part is that people don't even see they're doing it. Eventually, and they've been doing it here for 50 years, eventually there was no more money to be had. The work people, having even exhausted their savings, here we don't have any savings. In addition, the journey undertaken to obtain food was long, costly, and arduous, and generally 50% of the people were away from their occupation, losing their wages, and so making their position still worse and congesting the railways. At the same time, members of the local Soviet were continually seen in a drunken condition and were evidently living well. Exasperation grew, and finally the work people, with whom joined many of the peasants in the district, came in a body to me and asked my aid, but I was powerless to help. He can't help his own employees. In addition, I had to be very careful, as my words and actions could have been so misconstrued to the Soviet as to cause them to think that I was interfering in their functions. The fact of the people coming to me as of old, under the reign of the Tsar, for help alarmed the Soviet authorities, and open threats were made against me, and arrests of workmen followed. This was at the time of the outrage of the British Embassy at Petrograd, and on receipt of the news of same, I was advised to leave by certain members of the Soviet. So here we have an Englishman running a company in the Soviet, and he's just told to leave. Or he's probably in the same trouble. A meeting was then called by order to Moscow authorities in order to choose the quota of members of the requisition commandos of the Red Army from amongst the work people, who answered the summons by picking the members of the local Soviet, who were bitterly attacked and the actions and authority of the Soviet government repudiated. The speakers were arrested, and on demand of the crowd of the work people, numbering some 20,000, to release them, the guard of the local prison, consisting of members of the Red Army, opened fire, killing and wounding, it was stated, over 100 people. In addition, many were badly hurt in the panic which ensued. On the following day, all the mills and works in the district were stopped, the work people striking as a protest. So this is their response to the Bolsheviks. I then left the district for Moscow, not wishing to be made the center of an anti-Soviet movement, especially as the authorities were accusing British and French representatives as being the cause of many of the disturbances which were occurring all over the country, but which in reality were caused by their own reckless, unscrupulous, and utterly dishonest conduct. My house, with all contents, horses, carriages, and clothing, etc., were confiscated or requisitioned by the local Soviet. In addition, all my holding in the firm, including shares and loan money, were taken over by the central government, and jewelry, plate, and papers placed in the safe of the library at the Anglican Church, and furs stored in cold storage in Moscow were confiscated by the Moscow Tribunal. So he's an Englishman running a company in Russia. Everything's confiscated, and he lost everything.
And doesn't it happen again and again in country after country where communists come to power? Look what happened in Rhodesia when it became Zimbabwe, what's happening in South Africa, Southwest Africa, Bolivia. The communists basically simply appropriate other people's property without the pretense of legality.
Well, right, but in reality, they do it in the pretense of government or of a changing government and a people's revolution. And in reality, it's just Jews looting and pillaging entire nations. That's
and in this country, they call it eminent domain. All right, trade conditions in Central Russia. No statistics are available, but roughly the following can be taken as a fairly reliable estimate in October's last. Metal trades. The metal trade was practically at a standstill due to the shortage of fuel and raw materials, probably not more than 40% of the plant on all branches being in operation. Labor was thoroughly disorganized owing to political and economic disturbances and shortages of food products, which forced the work people to leave their occupations for long periods in search of food. The stocks of what little fuel, copper, lead, etc. that remained were being gradually exhausted, and no hope of recovery could be expected in the near future. Physically, the metal trades entail a heavy strain on the workers whose stamina was thoroughly exhausted by shortage of food. Linen trade. Production was 50% of the normal and was gradually being reduced owing to shortage of flax due to difficulties of transport and fuel. Work people were starving and absenting themselves from their work searching for food. Woolen trade. Production was decreased 60% owing to shortage of wool and fuel. Similar conditions prevailed amongst the work people as elsewhere in Central Russia. During the course of the summer, there was a stoppage of from 1 to 3 months of all the mills. The wool-producing districts such as Simbirsk, Kazan, Saratov, and Astrakhan were centers of great unrest, and no wool was to be obtained from these districts. Cotton trade. Production was decreased 60% below normal. This applies to all branches. Many mills were stopped altogether, and the stocks of cotton from these mills have been requisitioned and distributed to certain groups of mills which have been nationalized by the government. I imagine those are the ones that are immediately in Jewish hands. Probably 30% are stopped. Stoppages of all mills took place during the summer of from 1 to 3 months. At time of leaving, another period of stoppages of 1 month for all mills had been proclaimed by the government. Labor conditions, as in other trades, owing to economic and food troubles, were very unsettled. There was sufficient fuel to last 6 months. Stocks of cotton in Central Russia were roughly 1.5 million poods, the monthly requirement for all mills being 1.2 million poods. I don't know what unit of measurement that is. These stocks would allow of another 5 weeks of work. In Central Asia, it was estimated that there were the following stocks: 3.5 million poods of the old 1916-1917 crops and 2.5 million poods of the new 1917-1918 crops. On the Volga and on the Caspian Sea, it was estimated that there were another 1 million poods. These last stocks were, however, unavailable as the districts mentioned were practically cut off from communication with Central Russia. This year, 1918, it is calculated that only 30% of the land in Central Asia is being sown with cotton. In Central Russia, the staple trades are manufacturing in all its branches, woolen and silk. Of the raw materials required during the period of the war, 70% of the cotton has been obtained from Central Asia and Transcaucasia, Erevan, Kars, and Mugan districts, and 30% from abroad. Silk has also been obtained almost entirely from these districts, with the exception of a small quantity from Japan, which seems rather odd since Japan was at war with Russia just a decade ago.
Well, what he's saying was that Russian silk came almost exclusively from Russia itself, is basically what he's saying, except that a small quantity was imported probably each year from Japan.
Yes. With the closing of these markets to Russia, the textile industries will have entirely to close down, thus throwing out of work a great number of people. The Mohammedan populations in these districts are only too anxious to throw off the power of the Soviets, and would do so at once if they were sure of strong support on the part of the Allied governments. Several risings have taken place in the territories of the Emir of Bukhara and the Khan of Kireva, who themselves are very anxious regarding the safety of their own thrones, as there is in their dominions a party who support the Bolsheviks. And basically we're talking about Central Asia here, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. Silk trade. The silk trade is practically dead. All supplies of silk from Italy, Japan, Central Asia, and the Caucasus being cut off, and the stocks of silk are now exhausted. Paper trade. The paper trade has greatly decreased, probably the output of the mills being 60% of normal. Coal trade. The brown coal districts of Tula, Ryazan, and Moscow are giving 60% of their full production. The shortage is being caused by the absence of the workpeople. Strong attempts are being made by the Soviets to develop these districts since the Don coal fields were cut off from Russia. The results so far have not been encouraging. Peat industry. The working season as a rule is from May to July. The laborers employed are bodies of organized peat workers from the Ryazan government, supplemented during the war by German and Austrian prisoners. The work is heavy and requires great physical strength. The workers not having sufficient food could not produce their full complement of work. In addition, many workpeople did not leave their villages fearing famine. In consequence, production was only 60% of the normal. Great efforts have been made by the local authorities, especially in view of the fact that the stocks of coal and naphtha were exhausted, to increase the production of this class of fuel. The results were disappointing and gave no alleviation to the situation. Timber trade. Tracts of forests were being cut down for the use of the railways and industries, especially power stations, but the shortage of labor and disorganization of traffic prevented any serious results being obtained. The shortage of fuel has caused the authorities to close the schools or to curtail the period of instruction. Agriculture. The crops in 1918 have been in every case above the average, the government estimate being 120%. I don't believe that for an instant, do you?
Well, I mean the crops, the it may have been a good year for farming, but
the crops would have been
harvested it.
Oh, and they would have been planted one season before, wouldn't they?
Well, I'm not sure how quickly it took the Bolshevik Revolution to affect the planting by farmers.
Good point. Much hitherto uncultivated land was brought under the plow owing to the very high prices prevailing for food products. The price for same fixed by government being 20 rubles per pound for flour, which in private hands was being sold at 350 to 400 pounds per pood. The price for meat was fixed at 40 rubles per pood, but was being sold at 400 rubles per pood. Sugar was being sold at 25 rubles per pood. Under these conditions, the peasantry were making much money, as, for instance, one desitine of land produces on average in Central Russia 200 poods of potatoes, the average price of which was 40 rubles per pood, thus giving 8,000 rubles per desitine. As the average holding of the peasant is now 6 desitines, the sum earned as an average would probably be from 40,000 to 50,000 rubles per year. These prices were inducing the peasants to cultivate land which formerly was lying fallow. This may even cause a real and permanent improvement in methods of cultivation of land hitherto worked in a most primitive manner, as the peasantry are now demanding and buying good agricultural implements. Would you like to take over here for the state of transport? I could use a
I'd like to say, you know, farmers here are are being suppressed and their crops basically being stolen, and this has been going on for a long time, through the mechanizations I'm sorry, of the Jewish-controlled mercantile exchanges.
Oh, and I just found out a pood is 16.38 kilograms, approximately 36.1 pounds.
Okay. Now, when farmers can get, it's only natural when farmers think that they're going to get a good price for their crops, that all of a sudden they're much more productive. You know, they have a much greater impetus to go out and plant more. And these people, with the inflation that the Bolsheviks caused, actually probably thought that they were going to grow wealthy by planting more, that they were going to make some money. And we'll see that the, you know, that's at planting time, 6 months after the October Revolution. And then at harvest time, they didn't get to keep a whole lot of it. It's pretty evident from some of these reports that most of their food was confiscated and most of their crops were confiscated. And that destroyed the whole Russian economy was destroyed in a year.
And under the auspices of the FEMA program, didn't Reagan in the 80s give FEMA the authority through executive orders, or he gave them the power to go ahead and confiscate all agricultural produce in this nation in time of national crisis?
Well, right. We have everything that the Bolsheviks did, we have in place here to happen. I mean, there's no doubt through executive orders and through all of these agencies that there's no doubt that they could implement Bolshevism in this nation in a heartbeat, and they're poised to do it.
If there's serious opposition to what they're doing to us culturally at some point down the road, they will do away with all pretense of paying lip service to the Constitution. They'll just shred the document and throw it up in the air like confetti, and it'll be Bolshevism in America.
Well, I think they've broken down our entire culture, and there's been no need yet for them to do it.
Mm-hmm. But if a Hitler figure starts to emerge...
Oh, absolutely. I believe so. If there's a real conservative backlash in this country, yeah, they will do it. But so far, all of the conservative uprisings, including the Reagan Revolution, have really only been false flag operations. They've all been false fronts. The state of the transport. Transport by rail and water was still disorganized. But as the railways had their own separate organizations, which were more or less independent of the Central Soviet, matters were not as bad as in other branches of industry. There was a shortage of fuel, which consisted largely of timber and of lubricating oil, and there was still an enormous amount of railway stock lying unrepaired. The tramway services in Moscow and Petrograd had been decreased to one-fourth of the normal service owing to want of fuel. Motor transport, however, was being utilized without restriction, especially by the members of the many Soviets and their various organizations. It was stated that the stock of petrol in Moscow in August was roughly 50,000 poods. The river service on the Volga was practically suspended during the summer owing to the river being in a war zone. This greatly encumbered the already overworked railways. Recent legislation. This is good. All land, buildings, machinery, etc. were now nationalized, without any compensation being paid to the former owners. The result had been an utter deadlock, all private enterprise being killed. Money is being hidden to an enormous extent, the absence of which is being made good as quickly as ever possible by the Soviets' printing presses. Sounds like the Federal Reserve here. Private printing establishments being taken over for this purpose. It is estimated that the quantity of paper currency in circulation is now over 3 billion rubles, roughly 100 times the present gold reserve. A great quantity of false money is also being printed and being brought into circulation, especially the 20 and the 40 ruble note varieties. All private trading is being taken over by the government, and stocks are being confiscated. Gold articles over a certain weight are confiscated, with the result that same have disappeared, being hidden by the owners. The system of education has been entirely altered. All religious instruction has been abolished, and in its place, a form of state socialistic instruction substituted. Sounds like America, social studies and the abolition of religion in our schools. The peasantry now refuse to send their children to the state schools, and they remain without education. Clothing such as winter overcoats belonging to private people are being confiscated for the benefit of the Red Army. No man is supposed to possess more than one suit of clothes, two changes of linen, or two pairs of shoes. Anything above this is requisitioned for so-called state purposes. All furniture is nationalized. That's incredible. Political conditions. Make sure I have this right here, because I'm going to need this missing page. Throughout the districts occupied or administered by the Soviet government, 90% of the population is against the administration, and probably not more than 5% actively support the same. So 5% of the people supported the Bolsheviks. That's why I don't know, but I would like to find out more about the state of firearms in Tsarist Russia and firearms ownership, but I don't trust the sources that I have at hand. I don't trust the sources to be telling me the truth. I have to find some actual contemporary sources or some revisionist historical sources. But only 5% of the people in Soviet Russia supported the Soviet government, the Bolshevik government.
Now, I want to claim that your Wikipedia states that the Soviets did not enact any gun laws during the initial uprising.
If the people didn't have them.
Good point.
So that would indicate to me that maybe the people didn't have them. Throughout the districts occupied or administered by the Soviet government, 90% of the population is against the administration, and probably not more than 5% actively support the same. They had scythes and pitchforks, didn't they? I mean, they could just beat them with numbers. This 5% consists of returned political refugees, mostly non-Russian in race. Now, I wonder who he's talking about there.
Who could he be talking about?
Members of the many committees, commissariats, and government departments, Red Army recruits who are receiving high wages, and a certain number of fanatics, mostly young, of both sexes. So we have people on the government tit, and the Jews that came out of New York and returned to the Soviet Union, that returned to Russia, they are the 5%, basically. The remaining 5% support the Soviets simply owing to the fact that they are dependent on them for a living. Also amongst these are a certain number who are working for the purpose of getting acquainted with the organizations. This element could be depended upon to give valuable help in the event of a counter-revolution. Feeling is very bitter amongst all classes of the working population and peasantry, but these people are now so terrified, and in the case of town-bred working population, so weakened physically as to preclude any possibility of arising against the ruling power for the present. Regarding the form of government which the people desired, the majority, especially amongst the peasantry, wish a monarchy. From carefully noted inquiries of peasants and workpeople, I found that 90% were of this opinion. When we turn from the general aims of the Bolshevik policy to the actual situation in the big cities, as Petrograd and Moscow at the time when I left, it could be summed up in one word: famine. Get out of the city, people. As regards Petrograd, its population has now come down to 908,000, whereas in 1916 it was estimated at 2.5 to 2.6 million people. Two-thirds of the population have been able to escape to other parts of the country, and one-third remaining is reduced to starvation. The prices for food have risen to such an extent that all the principal commodities are out of reach of the buyer. The amount of food which is allowed by rations is in itself absolutely insufficient to keep up life, and then it is hardly regularly received. Sometimes bread is not received for 2 days consecutively. Besides, it must not be forgotten that the Russian population is divided into four classes. The educated and the capitalist class, being put into the third and fourth category, receiving three or four times less than the workmen and the other classes who are in the first and respectable category. Even the workman, who gets four times more than the others, cannot live on his ration and must buy bread and other commodities in an underhanded way, the open sale of them being forbidden. In order to give an instance, I wish just to say that an egg cost, when I left, 6 rubles, a bottle of milk, 6 or 7 rubles, a pound of bread, 14 to 17 rubles. The class which is the best fed in the army are the Bolshevik officers.
The class
which is the best fed is the Red Army and the Bolshevik officers. The foreign press has, as I understand, published some details about the September massacres in Petrograd, when more than 1,000 men were shot in Kronstadt, and at the Peter and Paul fortress indiscriminately, without any trial, not even the pretense of a court-martial, shot or drowned, as was the case with Father Ornatsky, the well-known priest of the Kazan Cathedral in Petrograd, who was drowned with his 2 young sons who were officers, along with many others. Whereas the shooting in the big towns has, during the last months, decreased owing to Lenin's personal dislike of red terrorism. Now, why don't I believe that? A charade, I believe.
Absolutely.
It has to be a charade. It has to be a pretense on Lenin's part to personally dislike red terrorism, because he could have stopped it, I'm sure, if he really wanted to. All right, I'll read on. It is continuing in the provinces where the priests, landowners, physicians, rich merchants, lawyers are indiscriminately shot in cold blood. Now I can say from this that, you know, that the Jewish war against the bourgeois is well expressed in the Communist Manifesto and in the Protocols of Zion. And really, it's a war against the middle class. Their definition of bourgeois are just the middle class.
Well, as far as the terror goes, I'd like to read a quote from Felix Dzerzhinowski, the head of the Cheka, who was a Polish Jew. This is from 14 July 1918. Quote, "We stand for organized terror. This should be frankly admitted. Terror is an absolute necessity during times of revolution. Our aim is to fight against the enemies of the Soviet government and of the new order of life. We judge quickly. In most cases, only a day passes between the apprehension of the criminal and his sentence. When confronted with evidence, criminals in almost every case confess, and what argument can have greater weight than a criminal's own confession?"
Well, if you read the Protocols of Zion, they demand, they say they'd be cruel. They said they'll destroy the clergy. They said that basically they'll demand submission, and they'll totally abuse any authority to get the job done, to bring people into total submission to them.
Here's their own paper, Krasnaya Gazeta, 1st September 1918, "We will turn our hearts into steel, which we will temper in the fire of suffering and the blood of fighters for freedom. We will make our hearts cruel, hard, and immovable, so that no mercy will enter them, and so that they will not quiver at the sight of a sea of enemy blood. We will let loose the floodgates of that sea without mercy, without sparing. We will kill our enemies in scores of hundreds. Let them be thousands. Let them drown themselves in their own blood. For the blood of Lenin and Yuritsky, Zinoviev, and Volodovsky, let there be floods of the blood of the bourgeoisie, more blood, as much as possible."
Well, they laid all this out for us. I mean, they've basically told us what they were going to do, and nobody believes it. you read the Communist Manifesto and you read the Protocols of Xi'an, and they told us everything they were going to do, and nobody believed it. They believed the lies when the Jews said, "Oh, those documents are frauds, or those the protocols aren't real," and every word of them's come true. Every bit of the Protocols of Xi'an have been unveiled as the Jewish plan for world conquest. And they've been successful so far in pulling it off. And only Yahshua Christ himself can stop the devil, I believe.
Absolutely.
Okay, they killed the landowners, physicians, rich merchants, lawyers, are indiscriminately shot in cold blood without any trial and without any reason besides a general pretext of being counter-revolutionists. Arrests and domestic searches are going on as before. There are some thousands of men and women starving in the prisons of Petrograd, professors of universities, eminent lawyers, priests, general officers, ladies of society, bankers, etc. There are towns and districts where all the priests who have to wear their hair long in accordance with religious custom have now been forced to have it cut short, and other towns, churches have been desecrated, and bishops arrested or shot.
So suffice to say that they're basically killing off the white elite to open up those positions for themselves.
Absolutely. There's no doubt. And they're a new religion, and that they're they'll replace the entire upper echelon of the society with Jews.
And in this country, they've done it peacefully.
Yes, they have. They've done it peacefully because, you know, the Tsar didn't want anything to do with the central bank. That's why this really happened. It boils down to the fact that the Tsar rejected Rothschild control of Russia. And this is what the Jews did in retaliation. And we let the Jews get away with it. We let them get away with it. So then that they used us to destroy Christian Germany. Who was, you know, Adolf Hitler was the next man to stand up to the Jews. And they destroyed him. And we helped them. And we in England, when I say we, I mean the English-speaking world, have simply ceded control to the Jews in a cultural revolution. We've just let them have it. We've just let them have the country. Under the conditions which I have outlined above, it is not astonishing that disaffection is growing, and it must be said that it is growing in all classes of the population. It is evident that the attitude of the educated classes against Bolshevism is one of impotent hatred. Well, that's funny, because in America for 100 years, the educated classes have just loved Bolshevism. That's odd, isn't it? Isn't that ironic?
Absolutely.
The news given out by Bolshevik employees is that the intellectual and bourgeois classes have allied themselves with the Bolsheviks is a deliberate falsehood. It is true that thousands upon thousands of these people have been induced to work under the Bolsheviks to accept some salaried situation with the government, but in respect to the working classes, it must be borne in mind that the industrial working man has practically disappeared from Petrograd in 1 year. Bolshevism has ruined Russian industry. The great bulk of the big factories, workshops, or mills do not work for a great many months or for want of raw materials. The workmen received from the state full pay for some time, but afterwards had to choose either to return to the villages or to enlist in the Red Army. And in most cases, they did the later. Well, obviously, you know, the Red Army was your ticket out of starvation, right? That's what it
Absolutely.
Seems to be.
Bill, in this country, isn't that how it's turning out? For a lot of people, the military is their ticket out of having to sleep in a car or a homeless shelter.
Right. The military is a ticket to a lot of kids into a job that's halfway secure and a steady paycheck. There's no doubt. There is no doubt. A lot of kids join the military out of desperation today, because it's the only way they'll get if they don't have wealthy Jewish parents, it's the only way they'll get a job and a steady paycheck. Okay. okay, I read that already. The small artisan is starving to death, which explains his anti-Bolshevik attitude. There remains the peasant far away in his village, rich with paper money and bread, which he does not want to give away, but the Bolsheviks are sending armed expeditions to steal bread, which they want to feed the Red Army. And I must say that the paper money that the peasant has is basically worthless.
Like our money today.
Oh, yeah, right. You can keep up all the cash you want today, but it's not worth much. The shooting of peasants every day by the Red Guards coming down for bread is an everyday feature. Revolutions have broken out, and nearly everywhere they are being quelled with blood. When we ask ourselves, who are the classes who support the Bolsheviks, the answer would be that they consist of the people who are fed and paid by the Bolsheviks, the Red Army, and the not less numerous army of paid government officials. Now let me say something from my own life experience. Because I worked for county government for 12 years, from 1981 until 1993. And the only people that voted in the local, in the elections that were not presidential elections, yeah, you know, like the municipal elections and the off-year elections and the primary elections, the only people I ever saw voting in those elections were the city workers, the county workers, the cops, the firemen, the school teachers. They're the only people that vote in those elections.
They have a stake in it.
Well, yes, they have a direct stake in it. But 90% of the rest of the people do not vote in those elections. And I watched this for years. And I understood why the party hacks always did well in the elections. Because the party hacks are the only ones that voted. And that's why they were never withstood. And I saw that for 12 years directly. I mean, firsthand. The only people that voted in the local elections in Jersey were the people that worked for the government and the teachers and the cops, the firemen, the people that had a direct stake in the outcome of the elections. Okay, where am I? Okay, all of them are paid more and fed better than the population amongst whom they live. And with the present food conditions, it is not astonishing that they stick to the Bolsheviks. The Red Army and the numerous army of different commissioners have also an unlimited opportunity of plundering the peaceful population, of which they avail themselves to an extent which, in the small provincial towns of the country, is simply terrifying, and which brings around the Bolsheviks all the lowest classes of the population. On the other hand, it must not be forgotten that Bolshevism had for many years its best recruits from among the young workmen of big factories who, as stated above, have now enlisted in the Red Army and who formed the socialist nucleus of the state. All political parties are declared to be outside the pale of the law as counter-revolutionary, and the old socialist parties, if they try to make public opposition to the Bolshevist tyranny, fare no better than the liberal parties. Especially the Socialist Revolutionary Party is subject to the most violent and bloody persecution. So Satan's house is divided against himself, right? Under these circumstances, can it astonish anyone that the public opinion, terrorized by imprisonment and numberless executions, remains dumb? It must not be forgotten that the Bolsheviks have formed small communities of the so-called poorest peasants in each village who are armed with rifles and often machine guns and who, being representative of the proletariat, have to exercise the dictatorship of the people over the village bourgeois, making up the majority of the peasants. The well-to-do peasant is thus completely excluded from any public activity and is kept terrorized by these committees, which in many cases are composed of the worst elements of the village, drunkards, ex-convicts, etc. Further, it cannot be doubted that the Russian people are worn out by the war and by the revolution, and that the love of peace, which was always a permanent feature of its national character, has been enhanced and has developed itself into an attitude of dumb suffering. The impartial reader of the Bolshevist press, and it must be taken into consideration that there does not exist any press with the exception of the official one now in Russia, can read in these official papers every day articles and information about local revolts which happen daily in various parts of the country, mostly villages where the peasants rise in an entirely unorganized way against the power of the Soviet. In the second part of November, such revolts have taken place in nearly all the districts of the government of Moscow and were suppressed mercilessly by the Red Army, composed to a considerable extent of Chinese and Letts. So the Red Army is composed to a considerable extent of Chinese and Lithuanians. That's an odd combination. Enemies from both borders, basically.
As the Lithuanians... Oh, Bill, I think the Lithuanians just had a grudge since the Russians had occupied their country for so long.
Right, I have to admit that I'm ignorant of Russian Lithuanian history before the First World War.
Well, the Polish Lithuanian Commonwealth was a bitter enemy of the Ukrainians, the Russians, the Cossacks, and there were frequent wars and skirmishes and raids back and forth over the last 300 or 400 years.
Well, I know there was always rivalry, like with France and Germany, but are you saying that Lithuania was occupied before the Bolshevik Revolution?
Yes.
Was it occupied before the First World War?
I don't know about that. I'd like to say it was. I know Russia occupied Finland, so I would also believe that they occupied the Baltic states as well.
I'll have to check up on that before next.
Okay, it says here that the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth was systematically dismantled from 1772 to 1795. The Russian Empire annexed most of Lithuania's territory.
Interesting. Russian industry is dead for the moment. Well, Lithuania was very large in the Middle Ages, actually.
Yes.
And it was, well, it was reduced to a pretty small place.
And according to Wikipedia, Lithuania had a huge Jewish community at this time, several hundred thousand.
Okay, then now we know who they are, eh? The usual war profiteers. Russian industry is dead for the moment, and the Russian industrial workman has ceased to exist as a class for the time being. It's amazing they did this in only 1 year. It is an extremely curious feature of the Russian Revolution that a movement which has proclaimed itself as social and democratic has achieved, in the first instance, total destruction of those social groups on which a social democratic organization is mainly based, the class of the industrial workmen. And that's what we were just talking about. All factories, all the important ones, with a few exceptions of those who are still engaged on munition work, are stopped, and the industrial workman had either to return to the village with which he had no more ties in common or to enlist in the Red Army. The younger generation of the workmen, men of 19 to 26 years, have to a great extent chosen the second alternative, and it is they who formed the Bolshevik nucleus of the Red Army. To speak of the growing success of the management of industrial concerns by Soviet is an absolute misrepresentation. It would be sufficient, in order to disprove this statement, to cite the instance of the most important factories and works in Petrograd, Moscow, and Izhny, where factories were engaged, which engaged usually many thousands, occupy now a few hundred men. As regards Petrograd, the number of executions is usually taken at 1,300, although the Bolsheviks admit only 500. But then they do not take into account many hundreds of officers, former civil servants, and private individuals who were shot in Kronstadt and in the Peter and Paul Fortress in Petrograd without any special order
from the central authorities by the discretion of the local Soviet. That's continued on the next page after it was cut off.
Right, right. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I had missed that.
Since we lost those two pages.
Well, right. There's no special order. The local Soviet was randomly and indiscriminately killing people.
And it says that 400...
away.
Oh, sorry, go on.
Well, I was going to continue reading. 400 were shot during one night in Kronstadt alone. Three big graves were dug in the courtyard, and the 400 placed before it. Then they were shot one after another. Now, isn't that what the Jews accused the Germans of doing? And it's the same thing the Jews accused the Germans of doing. They were the actual perpetrators of crimes like that. The Extraordinary Commission of Petrograd had on the orders of the day of one of their sittings the question of the application of torture. It is common knowledge that the unfortunate Jewish student who killed Brutovsky was tortured three or four times before his execution. So we see that there's a division amongst the Jews. And most of the, you know, most of the socialists were Jews, and the Bolsheviks were, they were torturing all the non-Bolshevik socialists.
And the Mensheviks.
Well, yeah, the Mensheviks are amongst the non-Bolshevik socialists. The Obukhov works were, in their majority, supporters of the Social Revolutionary Party or the other moderate socialist organizations. They summoned a meeting of the workmen at which, by an overwhelming majority, a resolution was carried, insisting upon the Bolsheviks putting an end to the Civil War and reconstructing the government on lines that would admit the participation of all socialistic parties. The Bolsheviks answered with the general lockout of the workmen and the closing of the Obukhov works. The population is everywhere divided into four classes for purposes of rationing, the middle and parasitic classes being in the third and fourth divisions. The parasitic class, that's a slight at the upper classes.
In actuality, they're the parasitic class.
Yeah, right, because they've never produced anything, the Bolsheviks. Getting one quarter or one-eighth the rations accorded to the workmen and the clerks. But even these rations remained mostly on paper, as there was not enough food to give them in the first place. Well, that's the state of Russia. It's definitely a reign of terror, or a second reign of terror. I mean, the first one was in the French Revolution. This is a repeat of it, and it's much worse. It's highly exacerbated.
All right, shall we continue on with part four, or shall we end on that note, or would you like to bring in material from the Third Rome?
Well, I don't have, you know, the Third Rome basically ends at the Bolshevik Revolution. And it's, I don't think it could add much to what we just read. There's nothing that it says that could really add to this terror that we see from these first-hand reports. And we've seen all of this that was implemented in the Bolshevik Revolution by the Bolsheviks has been implemented here in many ways just in times of peace. The super regulation of everything, the encroachment of government on all forms of property, and they're successful here without terrorizing the people. That they just brainwash them through television and academia. It's a slow torture instead of a long one.
So essentially we could say in this country they don't drag you out into the woods and shoot you in the back of the head. They simply make sure that you'll never get a job, so you starve to death in the street unless you're willing to capitulate and go along with what they want you to.
Well, it seems to be pretty much what they're doing here.
It's a more peaceful process.
And I'm not talking about the last 10 years. I'm talking about the last 100 years. That we've been blessed with Fabian socialism or a gradual descent into Marxism. Instead of the sudden one-year descent into Marxism.
So it's like a slow-acting poisoning with arsenic instead of an all of a sudden you're dead with cyanide.
Right, and really with all of our industry leaving or having left the country, it seems to me that we're very close to these conditions. I mean, there's already 10%, 15% of the country is unemployed by their admission, and the actual number is much higher.
Well, I consider traffic to be an indicator of unemployment, since when I'm driving around town on a daily basis, I notice that traffic has tripled or in some cases quadrupled, and I theorize that all these people are out either looking for work or they just don't want to stay home, so they've taken to the road, and that's why the roads are so packed now.
Well,
so
I don't know how they could if they're not working, I don't know how they could afford the gas to just cruise around. I mean, gas is almost $3 a gallon.
But I think that unemployment has to be at least twice what they're stating. Since almost everybody I know is out of work. Or they have a crappy job working at a gas station.
It's incredible, isn't it?
And the Jews have done that to this country seemingly overnight, haven't they?
Yeah, there are no. I haven't seen a manufacturing job around here or a real tradesman's job in quite some time now. Maybe 10 or 11 months.
All right, then. Shall we resume with part 4 next week, or would you like to get into that right now?
No, next week's good. I mean, it's an hour and a half is plenty, believe me.
All right. Excellent. Well, then, next week we will continue with part 4, and then we will begin to get into some of the particulars of daily life under the Bolsheviks, and eventually we will get into how the peasants were faring in regards to society, you know, the social cultural decline, and how the Jews in Russia held together the so-called Russian army.
How about how they implemented all the problems that they tried to bring to Germany in the Weimar Republic? We'll be coming to that also.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Yahweh bless.
Okay. Great, shall we?